We're doing the book of Shmuel, and we had left off with the story of the king of Ammon, the Ammonite king, who had done David a favor. He had saved the one relative that remained alive. So when this Ammonite king passed away, he had saved one of David's relatives, the only one that stayed alive. So David sent words of comfort to Nachash, the Ammonite king's, that had passed away, his son, Hanun. He sent words of comfort, and he wanted to repay his kindness. And it's interesting, Rashi on Divrei Hayamim, which isn't really Rashi, he says that God looked down and said, I said, don't show any favoritism to the Ammonites, and you think you're going to outsmart me? Look at what you're going to get from it. And what he gets from it is a war that endangers all of Israel, one of the most difficult wars we ever fought, because the Ammonite officers tell the Ammonite king, the fresh Ammonite king, they tell him, the Jewish Torah says you're not supposed to have any special favoritism, any special warmth towards the Ammonites after what they did to you when you left Egypt. They boycotted you. There's a special prohibition, the Torah says, lo tidrosh shelomam, don't seek their peace. So if King David sent you messengers, must be they're all spies. So what they do is they cut off half their clothing. They send them home half naked, and they cut off half their beards. And they send them home all embarrassed. These were wise men, old men, representatives of the kingdom, and this is how they treated them. And they realized that this meant war. Once upon a time, there was a concept of honor in the world, and there was a concept that if you do something like that, you were saying something. Now, David the Melech sent word to them. He said, don't bother coming home. You don't have to be all embarrassed. I heard what happened. He sent word to the elders. You guys stay in Jericho till your beards grow back. You don't have to come back looking like fools. Wait till your beards grow back. And the Ammonites realized this meant war, so they went and hired the different Aramean armies. They hired tens of thousands of soldiers, and David sends his chief general, his nephew Yoav, the son of his sister Tzeruya, with the army to fight them. And they go to war, and they ambush him, and Yoav finds himself surrounded. He's taken on two sides. And he takes half the soldiers with him, he takes part of the soldiers with him, and he chooses his soldiers, and then he gives the rest of the soldiers to his brother Avishai, and he tells him the famous line, he tells him like this, "In techezak ara mimeni, if the Arameans overpower me, so vayita li Yeshua, you'll save me. If the Ammonites overpower you, valachti lo shialach, I'll come and save you." And then he says the famous line, Chazak v'nit chazak v'adameinu. Let's strengthen ourselves, let's redouble our strength for our nation, v'adarei lokeinu, and for the nation, for the cities of God, v'ashem yaseh tov beinav, and God should do what's good in his eyes. So this chazak v'nit chazak, they didn't have much of a choice. And if they lost, then all of Israel was in danger. Here the army was surrounded, really. And Yoav was victorious. And when the Ammonites saw that the Arameans had fled, so they ran back into their city. And Yoav was confident that he had put this war, he had ended it. He went back to Jerusalem. The Arameans saw that they had lost, so they regrouped. And they figured now they'll be successful. And they gathered another Aramean colony with them, with more generals, and when David hears that they've amassed great numbers, so he gathers a larger army and crosses over the Jordan. He's not waiting for them to attack, and they fight it out on the other side of the Jordan, and again, they're victorious. King David kills 700 chariots, 40,000 horsemen, and the chief general, and at that point, they subdue the Aramean army, and the Ammonites remain a formidable force against us. A year has passed, and Yoav is sent out, and they lay siege on the capital of Ammon. David remains in Jerusalem. And now we are about to see one of the most difficult stories in Jewish history, the story of David and Bathsheba. If you want, on TorahForMe.org, we have classes from previous years where we did the story in depth. we'll only mention a few of the Midrashim now, even though Chazal discussed this story extensively. Chazal go into great detail and tell us a lot about this story. We'll just mention a little bit, a dabbling. This story really needs a lot of learning, and you can see we discussed it in other classes. Chazal tell us that David asked God, he said, I'm doing the best I can as your servant. God had told him that he's going to have a dynasty, that he was chosen as taking the crown of kingship for the people of Israel, that his children and descendants would be God's chosen ones. And David realizes that he plays a very special role, and he does the best he can in his service of Hashem. And he wants to know what remains for him to advance. Is he not doing the best he can? And at one point in conversation with God, he asks God how he could make it to the level of the patriarchs. That just as we say that God is the protector of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, how could he enter that league? And God says, no, you don't. So David says, why? And God says, I tested them and I didn't test you. And at this point, David makes a fatal error. David asks God to test him. And David will later on compose whole verses and psalms begging for forgiveness for asking to be tested. And God tells him, okay, I told you you're not fit for it, but you want to try, so I'm going to make your test even easier than theirs, because I'm going to tell you in advance what the test is going to be, and I'm going to tell you in advance that you're going to fail. And so God tells him, I will test you with a married woman. We have on tradition that this married woman was predestined to be David's wife. And so when David sees her and is attracted to her, he's right in being attracted. He feels like this is his soulmate, and he's right. But right now she's married to someone else. Those of you who were here about 2 months ago, we discussed the Medrash about how it happened that the woman who was supposed to be David's wife ended up being Uriah the Hittite, who became a convert, who became one of David's top soldiers, how she became his wife. Also by an error that David did. So now, David goes out to the roof. And that is error number one, or number two. His first error was in asking to be tested. And he goes out to his rooftop in the evening, and we have on tradition that the Satan decided he's going to take him down now. And so he appeared before him like either a dove or something he wanted to hunt. And he quickly grabbed his bow and arrow and tried to shoot it and missed. And when you're dealing with an angel, so he could get it just right, he had it exactly hit a curtain and sliced down a curtain. And guess what? Behind that curtain was a beautiful young girl named Bathsheba, little girl. And she was just coming out of the mikveh, not clothed. And David is struck by her beauty. And Bathsheba's husband is Uriah, one of David's top soldiers. Later in the end of the book, he is recorded as one of the brave soldiers of David who merit mentioning. Her grandfather is David's advisor, a young man named Achitophel, a young man who is one of the most brilliant advisors that ever walked the planet. Later on, the book will describe Achitophel as being so smart that asking his counsel was the equivalent of asking God. That's how the Navi describes it later. And he was a young man, meaning he married very young and had a child, and his son married very young and had a child. So although she is about 7 years old when this story takes place, her grandfather is in his 30s. He's about 30 or something like that. Achitophel, her grandfather, pretty young. Our sages have an interesting tradition as to what happened at this moment, which deserves a class unto itself, as we discussed. Our sages say that David felt himself being overtaken and said, no, I won't, God, I'm going to prove you wrong. And then David stood there and said, but that's pretty audacious of me to prove God wrong. And then David went forth and sinned. And he had the woman summoned and he slept with her. And she goes back home and she sends word and tells him she's pregnant. Is she a married woman? Well, yes and no. How so? We have on tradition that David's father already instituted in the Jewish army that when a man goes out to war, he leaves his wife with a divorce contract. And when he gets back home, he remarries her. Now, that was to ensure that women weren't left in this state of limbo. When a woman, her husband is MIA, missing in action, so then halachically she cannot remarry because she's a married woman, and it's biblically prohibited to the point of a person should rather get killed than commit adultery. If we don't know if he's dead, so she doesn't know what her status is, and in halacha we consider that the worst torment, to the point where we would allow her to marry someone else, because we say the suffering is so great for a woman to be in this bind, what we call in halacha an aguna. We would technically allow her to do it if it weren't such a severe sin that the Torah says you have to give up your life rather than commit adultery. Meaning, we consider it so painful for a woman to be in this state that we do everything to avoid it. And in halacha, we summon the greatest rabbis to find room for leniencies, and we do everything in our power to ensure that a woman does not get caught in this situation. So one of the things that they did, starting with Yishai, David's father, was that when a man went out to war, he would divorce his wife. And then when he'd come back, he'd remarry her. So technically she's not married. But imagine what every soldier is going to feel like when he hears that the king took someone's wife, because technically she's not married. Halachically, she's a single woman. So soldiers aren't going to be too happy. And it's going to be a pretty serious desecration of God's name. And if you stop and think about it, you got to ask yourself, why is this written in the Bible? God could have left this out, right? We didn't have to know this gory detail of Jewish history. So then maybe we have to learn something from this. Not maybe, definitely we have to learn something from this. We have this misconception that giants of Jewish history were perfect. And it's not true. The Talmud tells us there is no such concept as a human being who is a saint. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, who attained the level of an angel, had his faults and had his errors and had his sins and died. Every human being is human and they have their faults. And even David has his faults and he has his moment of weakness, and he's going to pay a very hefty price for that moment of weakness. So although technically he didn't live with a married woman, but what he did was a desecration of Hashem's name. And what he's about to do is also something which God holds him to task over. So David realizes that he has to try and cover this up. So what David does is he sends word to the general Yoav, and he says, send me back Uriah the Hittite. And Uriah is summoned to King David's chambers. And when Uriah comes in, so David asks him how the chief general, how Yoav's doing, and how the nation's doing, and how the war is doing. And then David tells Uriah, go home and wash your feet, which is a gentle way of saying, go home and be with your wife. And Uriah leaves David's home, and David wants to ensure that Uriah goes home and remarries his wife and thinks that she became pregnant from him. So what David does is he sends a royal dinner together with Uriah. You know, you come home, you have a good steak, there's a beautiful atmosphere. He sends home a royal dinner, Mas'at HaMelech, together with Uriah. But Uriah doesn't go home. Uriah doesn't even go into a bed. Uriah goes to sleep at the entrance to David's home, together with all of David's servants. And David gets word, Uriah did not go home. So David summons Uriah and he says, you know, you've come from a long journey. Why didn't you go home? And Uriah says to David, and here we see the piety of this man. He says, the Aron, the Ark, is not in its place. It's out at war with us. And here we have a great discussion among our sages. Did they take the Ark out every time they went to war? And this is where we have the discussion. Did they have two Arks? One that went to war and one that stayed in the tabernacle. One that stayed in the tent. So here there's a big discussion. And Israel is living in huts, and my master Yoav and all of the servants of my master are out there on the field camping, and I'm going to go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife. I swear by your life and my life I wouldn't do such a thing. Everyone was out at war when David did what he did. And Uriah is telling him back a line like this, and notice how the Navi quotes word by word. Again, remember, God could have left this out of Jewish history, and God did not. God is teaching us something here. And David tells Uriah, okay, tomorrow you're going to go back to the camp. And when David stays with him, when Uriah stays with him, so then David summons him and he gives him a lot to eat and he gives him a lot to drink, to the point where Uriah is drunk. And David assumes a drunk man goes home, like Shakespeare said, you know, the wine puts one in an amorous mood, right? You guys know, right? So Uriah, deep down inside, is as pure as he is outside. So Uriah doesn't go home. He goes to sleep again in the same spot. Now, technically, halachically, the way Uriah spoke to David was disrespectful. David tells him to do something, and he says, I swear by your life and mine, I ain't going to do it. You don't talk to a king that way. Although what Uriah said stemmed from piety, the way Uriah spoke by referring to Yoav as his master when he's talking to the king, and by talking to David in this way, technically at this point David could have him beheaded. Because technically Uriah just rebelled against the king. That manner of speech was deserving of the death penalty. But David chooses not to do that. David sends a message in Uriah's hand to Yoav. And he tells Yoav, when you go to war, make sure Uriah is in a place where there's a harsh battle, and then you guys move back and leave him to be killed by the sword of the Ammonites. And that's what happens. Yoav obeys David, and they go fight, and Yoav chooses a position where he knows the top Ammonite warriors are positioned. And he pulls back, and the people attack, and soldiers die, and among them is Uriah. Pause. We have a tradition that another thing happened here. We have a tradition that within the army there was a mutiny at this point. The soldiers surrounded Yoav, and they said, what's wrong with you? How did you do that to Uriah? That was no way to fight a war. How do you retreat and leave our top soldier on the front lines? And at this point, the soldiers were starting to form a rebellion. At which point, Yoav, under pressure, pulled out the letter and said, David told me to do it. And he showed everyone the letter. And David is later on going to take Yoav to task over that. But that is one of the reasons that the story becomes public. People are now going to know that David wanted Uriah dead. And that is going to be the root of a future rebellion against David. It is going to be at the root of great enmity by Bathsheba's grandfather Achitophel, who will work to destroy David. And it will be at the root of a lot of people's hatred for David, which can be understood, to the point that people will question King Solomon's right to the throne. People will question whether God even wants David and Shlomo's temple. People will question whether God even sides with David. And this question will not be settled until the erection of the temple. At which point, Shlomo tries to enter the temple, and there was a mistake in the architecture, and nothing works, and they can't enter. And King Solomon stands outside, and everyone's wondering, why can't we enter? And it turns out that they didn't exactly figure out that certain things, the Aron can't really fit through the doors. And that was a miscalculation, it would seem. The Medrash describes it that the doors were sealed and they couldn't get them open. And King Solomon prays and prays and prays and prays. And everyone's praying and everyone's trying and nothing works. Until finally they step back and King Solomon says a prayer. And he says, open up the gates for the sake of David, your servant. And suddenly the gates swing open. And then everyone stands there and they see that and they say, huh? And that's the moment, only after David dies, only over a decade after David dies, only then will people recognize that God was willing to forgive him. It's not that he didn't sin. It's not a question of whether what he did was right or wrong. It's a question of, did he attain forgiveness? And the greatness of David is the capacity to overcome his failings. It's not that he doesn't have failings. It's not that he doesn't have weaknesses. The greatness of David is that he keeps getting back up. The difference between a tzaddik and a rasha is not about whether they fall. It's about whether they get up from the fall. And that's what we're taught. Sheva yipol tzaddik vakam. A tzaddik is one who keeps getting back up. If you think a tzaddik is someone who doesn't fall, that's not a tzaddik. That's not a human being. And so David is now about to suffer a downfall that will take him for a very turbulent ride for the rest of his life. And the greatness of David is that he doesn't get knocked down totally. That he keeps getting back up to the point where he gains forgiveness. To the point where God even says, I want the son of Bathsheba to sit on that throne, this same Bathsheba, who he took in an improper way. Well, her son is going to be King Solomon, and God is going to choose him. And God is going to say about Shlomo, call him Yedidya, the friend of God. But first we have a story to pass. So Yoav sends word back to David, telling him what happened at war, and he tells the messenger, he wants to keep things a little under wraps, he says, tell David the story of what happened, and if the king gets all upset, why'd you go near the city? People threw things down from the city. Anyone could kill a person from the top of the city. If you come close, anyone could just drop anything of weight and kill someone. So then make sure to tell the king, oh, Uriah was also king. So the messenger doesn't wait for David to get all upset. He tells him, you know, we approached the city and then we were victorious in the war. And then suddenly when we approached the city, they started shooting down at us from the walls and people were killed, including Uriah the Hittite. And David says, well, go tell Yoav, don't feel bad. This is the way of victory. Sometimes people have to die en route. And you continue, you will be victorious over the city. And that's the end of that story. Uriah's wife, notice the Navi calls her his wife, hears that her husband died. She eulogizes him. And when the mourning period is over, David gathers her, he marries her, and she has the child. David wants to be quick to marry her so that things don't get out. There won't be a worse desecration of Hashem's name. Notice Hashem doesn't let him get away with it. Hashem records it for world history. Till today we read about it. He tries to do it under wraps. And the Navi concludes this chapter by saying what David did was bad in the eyes of Hashem. And Hashem sends the prophet Natan to David with a fantastic story about two people in one city, a wealthy person and a poor person, and Natan is going to do a fantastic job getting David to realize his faults. That's where we're going to pick up Bezrat Hashem in the beginning of the continuation of how David gets out of this next week.